And as a matter of fact, they hired Brockway at Michigan.
Oh, really?
I'm pretty sure he was the one. And then I told the people at Pittsburgh Plate Glass that I was sorry that I couldn't accept, but I thanked them for their consideration, etc. There may have been one or two other places. I'm trying to recall now. I also got, I had already accepted the job at Illinois, and I got an inquiry from one of the departments at DuPont's. And I believe I was visiting a lake in the northern part of the state where my sister, older sister, and her husband had a cottage. And a wire came from the what was called the ammonia department at that time. And I told them that, I sent a wire back indicating that I couldn't meet with them, that I was already committed to a job at the University of Illinois, which turned out to be very fine indeed. I thought that was a happy circumstance for me, and I never failed to recognize that I was lucky too. In other words, it's one thing to say, hey, you know, if you can achieve something, that's great. But there are too many things that can go sour at times that you don't just take these things for granted. And the timing was right. There was a pickup of business. There was a surge of hiring. And I was able to get the kind of job I wanted at what was regarded as one of the best chemistry departments in the country, albeit the Citadel for organic chemistry, and I was a physical chemist, so I was not in the best physical chemistry department in the country by any means. By all odds, the best physical chemistry was University of California, Berkeley, and Caltech, I guess Princeton, places like that.
You had mentioned Lind before. You said you
were
saying
yes.
Something about
that. Samuel Lind was perhaps the most distinguished person on the faculty at University of Minnesota. You didn't see too much of him because there was a lot of demand for his time and so on. He was one of the early workers in radioactivity. He worked in Madame Curie's laboratory. And, well, actually, I think the history is that he went to Bodenstein's laboratory in Germany. I forgot. I guess it was Göttingen, but I'm not sure. I wouldn't vouch for that. Anyhow, he worked there, and then he went to Madame Curie's laboratory in Paris. And he worked on the effect of alpha rays on chemical reactions. Vector radiation promoting chemical reactions. So there was a lot of work prior to the nuclear bomb work of World War II, which was sort of not too exciting background to what these things do. He knew something about separation of the elements. Back in those days, what you wanted was the radium. Uranium was the parent ore, but you wanted the offspring, the radium. He worked with radon, what you could do with radon, and he was very much an authority on the radioactive decay families, and on what was up to then known about chemical reactions induced by, and something about the biological effects of radiation. I remember his talking in a course on radioactivity, which I took from him as an undergraduate. He talked about the dangers of radioactivity even back then. And I remember a rather poignant little story he told about watch dials, which would have luminous dials. They would paint, they would have paint with some radioactive material in, literally, and they would put in some radium, on your watch dial. And he said, and I remember this, he said, you know, they would have these women in factories who would have these little brushes, tiny brushes, and they would tip the brush in their lips, you know, they would twist it around so that they'd get a fine point to put in, and so on. He said, that was bad. There was no government regulations mm-hmm. about such matters back then. Well, there were doubtless suits and claims and so on, but there was no guidance. Talk about environmental problems or earth workplace problems. By today's standards, that would be absolutely inexcusable. Yeah. See, I remember his telling this story. Then he also told a story which is very interesting. He said, you know, you could get by with thorium B on these watches. And, but, and thorium B would be cheaper, but to get an establishment to start separating thorium B, when we've got establishments that have already separated radium, they would, they blocked it. And it was a case of the establishment blocking the use of thorium B. And he said, but you know, thorium B has a half-life of 8 years. Radium, nearly 2,000 years, you know. And the half-life of a small watch is more nearly 8 years than 2,000 years. It probably makes sense to use thorium B there. And so, but he pointed out, what was one of the early cases of hearing from an authority about how the business operation had a bearing on what you would do in terms of rationality. Of course, more rational not to use any radioactive material, but if you were going to use one there, it would make more sense to use thorium B's. And I remember Samuel Lind making these statements. It's curious how you remember something, but those have a certain kind of an impact, then you remember them, because it wasn't just an incidental thing, it stuck.
Yes, yes, absolutely. When you got to Illinois, what were your first teaching assignments?
Oh, my first assignment, and this was ostensibly what I was hired for, was to teach physical chemistry to pre-medical students. They, back in those days, prior to my going there, the pattern had been, pretty generally, that pre-medical work was 2 years of, say, liberal arts and sciences, or you could substitute a lot of things. Anyhow, 2 years of work. Then you go to medical school. Well, they were going to change, and did change, the pre-med requirement from 2 years pre-med to 3 years pre-med. And one of the things that would be involved in the third year of pre-med would be physical chemistry, an introduction to that. There would be some other things they'd have to do, more biology and so on. I don't remember precisely what, but I do remember the physical chemistry because that's what I was to teach. So I, my first job was to find a suitable text for teaching pre-meds and to think about how I was going to teach them. Then I had a second teaching job, too, and this had to do with drawing on some of my experience at Caltech. I would talk about the nature of the chemical bond, something I learned from Pauling, of course, and which I also studied by myself, to be sure, and various subtle things, not subtle, various more advanced things that the students ought to hear about. And this was a graduate course, this one, the undergraduate for pre-meds. The pre-med course worked out pretty well, and but it got a reputation for being the course that was designed to eliminate the students who couldn't make the grade. And but the feedback was not not an unhappy one to me. I didn't mind people saying this is a course you have to work hard at. That made me feel good, see. And if they said I was a good teacher, as some did, that made me feel good too. So put it all together, I didn't mind people saying this is the course that eliminated the lone students. So I taught that for a number of years. That was my principal assignment, and I taught this other course for graduate students. And that I don't know just how many years this was. Meanwhile, of course, I was getting on to my on with my research. I did enjoy teaching, though, and I should explain that at the end of the first year, when I went in to talk with Roger Adams about how my first year had been, you know, I didn't have much of a chance to talk with him. It was kind of a treat to be able to talk with him. You know how it is, this man up in the clouds, if you can only get in to talk with him occasionally, see, but once in a while you could do that, and I think he may have called me in, as he did to all the other youngsters, and how are things, you know? And I said, well, fine, doing this, what have you been doing? Well, I talked about the various things, and then I made the statement that with regard to teaching, I said, you know, I enjoy that teaching. He looked at me kind of quizzically, you enjoy teaching? And that look was enough to persuade me that I shouldn't have said I enjoyed the teaching. I should have emphasized the research, which I also enjoyed. Mm-hmm. I never again told Roger Adams I liked teaching, because this is an indictment in a way of him, but I caught the nuance of that expression. In other words, you're not going to be one of these fellows who isn't going to do something that'll make this department greater, are you? Now, by the same token, let me assure you that I had a great regard for Roger Adams, and he did a lot of things for me, and I can tell you more about that later. But that one little incident shows where he put his money and contributed to the feeling that has often been cited, that universities been accused of emphasizing research and scholarship and letting teaching go to the dogs. He made that one statement which sounded that way to me and which had an impact on me. Not that I heeded it. I did not heed it. But I never bragged about teaching. So, huh?
That's amazing.
It's rather amazing,
yes.
Really.
Yes.
Because usually a fellow would sort of, well, that's nice, you know, that you enjoy it, you know. But he gave me that kind of, how come look. So, at any rate.
What kind of research problems were you starting on?
Well, my first problems, I did some work on, with the infrared, spectroscopy, infrared spectroscopy, which was done largely in collaboration with Werther Rotebusch, who had acquired an infrared grating and spectroscopic outfit, and he was very generous in letting me work with it. I also started in on some theoretical work. I did a couple of things on covalent and ionic character in
yes, you had a paper on the ionic character in diatomic molecules.
Yeah.
Very early.
That's right, yeah. I don't remember just exactly the order in which, well, I could find off in the list there. But I started doing some theoretical work, and then I got into theoretical work for polymers in a very interesting way. There was a distinguished organic chemist at Illinois by the name of Marvel, Speed Marvel, you've heard about him, who had a problem about some reactions in polymers that called for a statistical analysis. I don't know if he used statistical analysis or not, but anyhow, he said, you know, you conduct this reaction and it goes only so far and it won't go any farther, and there was a statistical explanation. I won't go through all the details. And it was referred to me. He sent one of his students around to talk to me, and the student wanted to know of him first why this unusual situation prevailed. He says, I don't know, why don't you go talk to Fred Wall? So he came down and talked to me, and I got into that problem. Then I started to work on it, and I saw that Flory had done something on it, and I studied what Flory had done. Then I extended it and did some of my own, and then I got very much interested in polymers and the possibility of using statistical methods in connection with describing polymers. And this was a rather important step in terms of the impact of future research for me, because then I got involved in theory of rubber-like elasticity and the size and shapes, configurations of rubber-like molecules. And that was an outgrowth of asking why it was that a polymer behaved in a certain way. And so I dropped, well, I had done a number of other things too. It was partly probing around, but I worked with enthusiasm, I think, but every time I was not yet really what you'd say in the groove, you see, until I got to polymers. And then the potential became clear, and the thing seemed to open up in terms of all kinds of things that could be done, because the polymer business was suddenly expanding, not only industrially, but there was just so many things that you could deal with from a physical chemical point of view that it was a fertile field. Well, the war broke out, and I had already gotten started in polymers, but one of the things that was necessary, of course, was to do something about rubber, because our rubber plantations or the plantations in the Malay were cut off by the Japanese, and we needed rubber for our, obviously, for our tires and other things. So being interested in polymers, knowing, of course, that rubber is a polymer, I went to Roger Adams and said, you know, if there's anything I can do along these lines that might be helpful, I'd really like to. Perhaps I could do some consulting for a rubber company on matters of this kind so that I can combine whatever interests I have from the more academic to the practical application, thus make a contribution to what is an important problem. Well, he thought that was pretty reasonable, so he wrote to the U.S. Rubber Company, then called U.S. Rubber, I forgot what it is now. You know, there have been these mergers and combinations, and yes. Hell, Lord knows what. Anyhow, they had a laboratory in northern New Jersey. I forgot the name of the town now. Not Elizabeth, but, well, that's neither here nor there. But at any rate, I got a little consulting job with them, and we talked about various aspects. And then the government started a rubber research program. Mm-hmm. And they were looking for people in the academic community to work on this program. And among other things, they came to the University of Illinois and they talked to Marvel, who was the senior man in rubber, and he was an organic chemist and concerned with synthesis and so on. Of polymers, yeah, but they wanted a physical chemical offshoot in conjunction with it at a number of schools. So Marvel came to me and says, Fred, would you like to work on the physical chemistry of this under this program, see? And I thought that was a pretty good idea. And so I volunteered to do that. Well, then it turned out that a number of companies, U.S. Rubber, as well as Goodyear and Goodrich and I forgot who else, but not all the rubber companies, were also going to participate in this. And then it turned out that U.S. Rubber said that if I'm getting paid, and I was now going on leave part-time for research, because back in those days, well, if you got any money from the government, you could reduce some of your teaching, and I was going to get, say, half my salary from this government program. If I was getting that, then there was a question of whether I could get money from the government from two channels, one indirectly through U.S. Rubber and one through, and they thought maybe I had to sever that relationship because they'd hear about what I was doing anyhow in the meetings that we'd be having. See, well, that made me disappointed because that was my first industrial consulting, and I had heard that this can be very nice remuneratively. Which is a nice thing when one's young, just married and thinking about a family and that sort of stuff. So Speed said, well, I'll tell you what, you know, the DuPont company's thinking about, they want some physical chemistry. And the DuPont company was very much identified with, academically, with the University of Illinois. The University of Illinois fed them organic chemists. There was one time when three of the directors at the Central Research Department out of four were from the University of Illinois. The PhDs of Roger Adams and Marvel, and both Adams and Marvel were consultants. And DuPont said, maybe we need a little physical chemistry. Roger Adams says, well, you know, we got a fellow who's interested in polymers and so on who can help you. And he recommended me. And it was Roger Adams who did the job for me. I got a consulting job from DuPont, the Central Research Department. And that was a most rewarding type of consulting arrangement I've ever had in my life. And I don't mean when I use the word rewarding in the honest sense, not it was remuneratively rewarding too. Let me say it made the difference between paying off the mortgage and having a family and not having to. It really from that point of view, but more than that, it brought together. It provided the opportunity for really bringing academic thinking into the industrial place, and DuPont was sufficiently sophisticated. It was by all odds the most sophisticated chemical company in the country when it came to research. They understood what it meant at that time. They understood what it meant to think in terms of the long run. None of this, hey, give us the answer tomorrow. And there was none of this, well, ask the consultant the answer. If he doesn't know, he's no good. I mean, quite the contrary. They'd say, look, you engender the feeling for asking questions, doing things. Ask people the right questions. Find out why they're doing things the way they're doing. And if you know an answer, give them the answer. But this was the way the consulting developed. And it was a really wonderful kind of a relationship. So we could talk about polymers, we could talk about things, and I could ask them why they're doing something and ask them more questions, probing them as you might almost probe a doctoral candidate in his preliminary examination. And out of it, you could elicit the answers which they had, but which they didn't know they had until you ask questions why, and first thing you know, they put things together and they say, hey, you know, I'll bet you it's like this. That was the most satisfying part of the consulting. Well, the unhappy part was that I spent too much time consulting. This was an unhappy situation in that I was on the road more than I really should have been for the sake of my family and so on. We had now two children, two daughters, and I was shuttling off to Wilmington, and not only Wilmington, where the Central Research Department was, they called it the Chemical Department then, and the Purity Hall is where they would have this sort of thing. That's where they just first discovered nylon and they had the commitment for long-range things. Well, then the Fabric and Fibers Department wanted me, so I made a few trips down to their rayon plant down in Richmond, Virginia, and up to Buffalo, where they had cellophane, and Waynesboro, Virginia, where they had acetate rayon, and so on. Well, they were beginning to really take up too much of my time. So I whittled down limited pretty much, well, I did limit it to the Central Research Department. And
you had a number of patents.
Well, yeah, but...
Three or four or something like that.
Yes, there are several patents, and, well, it's curious. You know, you talk with the people, and they ask about something, and you say, well, why don't you try this, or what have you done? And in one instance, at least, I got a letter from a fellow saying, you know, you were telling me about such and such. I've written a patent application based on what you said, and I hope you don't mind, and would you concur? And you signed it, and you signed it to the company. I didn't even know I was talking a patent to him. It was a part of the game where I was not thinking patents. I was simply thinking science. Mm-hmm. One of them was very academic indeed. It had to do with how you could make a nylon that would resist resist the deleterious effects of heavy sunlight on it, where it loses some of its pliability and so forth. And it was established that something known as the alpha hydrogens in the nylon chain were the bad actors. And I said, well, if you can put a substituent there, it might work. You know, that's a little hard to do, but you could, well, I said, you can establish the principle, though, as follows. Suppose you were to put deuterium, heavy hydrogen, in those alpha positions just as a test to verify this hypothesis as to where the bad actors are. Because the deuterium, being twice as heavy as the hydrogens, has a different vibrational frequency. It isn't going to be kicked off the way sunlight will kick off the hydrogen. So try it. So by gosh, they made some nylon with deuterium in the alpha hydrogen positions, and it resisted the sun. And now, they weren't going to start making nylon that way, not with heavy water. This was to establish a principle, which was the whole reason. But you know, they got a patent on it. They did indeed. They got a patent on that kind of thing. I would say that there's one chance in a million that they'd ever stick it on and they use it commercially, see. But it was new knowledge. They knew how to do it. It satisfied them scientifically. And somebody says, well, get a patent. By the time they spend all the money in the research, the patent is chicken feed. I mean, especially since nobody's going to quarrel with that. I mean, nobody's going to see big bucks in that kind of a thing. And then I had a couple of others that I just never imagined would lead to patents. The only disappointments I had with DuPont, though, I gave them a couple of good ideas that they rejected. And in retrospect, they were really good ideas. They had synthesized a new chromium oxide, which had a different stoichiometry from the normal one, and they discovered that it had some remarkable magnetic properties. Well, this is at the time when magnetic tapes were just, you know, getting to the vogue. And I said, look, if it's got more remarkable magnetic properties than, say, iron oxide, you've got a potential use here. Well, it's pretty expensive. Iron oxide, cheap. I says, I don't care if it's expensive or not. You find out whether it's useful. And if it's useful, maybe even make it cheap enough to be of some good. Well, that's a thought. So they studied the magnetic properties some more, and they made some tapes out of it, and they could what they said were better tapes than 3M was making, see, for recording. This is well before TV even, which is still quite, I shouldn't say there wasn't any TV, but they didn't have VCRs and that sort of thing. They said, it's better. But the trouble is, it's only about 10% better. And our sales department says, it was only 10% better. You can't tool up for it. Not until you're twice as good do you start a new factory and start doing things, and then you can get into it. But if it's 10% better, we'd be licked by 3M, who has the background and the advertising and all that. See, so they dropped it, and I thought that was a dreadful mistake because I was convinced that there was going to be a future in magnetic tape. I didn't know exactly where. Then along came the business about recording TV programs. So I reinstituted it. I said, hey, look, it isn't just a matter of tape for a few computers, you know. It's going to be for a big business. So they looked at it again. Well, this time they went to other people and licensed out. And it's being used now. But if they had gotten started right then and there, they'd have had what is non-trivial business right now. It would have been terrific.